thanks for coming back. Today, I had the rare opportunity to chat with someone who, wouldn't you know it, is an in real life friend. Like, not just the cyber stalking Instagram DM parasocial relationships we've all kind of had to get used to as the norm, like someone I've actually met in person and chatted about books and writing and life and kids. And it was a nice change. So today I'm really excited that I had the opportunity to talk with Nathan Whitlock, author of the satiric novel Lump. Lump is a dark comedy about marriage, motherhood, privilege, and power, about a woman whose attempt to escape crises in her health and marriage ends up causing only more chaos. Nathan is the author of the novels A Week of This and Congratulations on Everything. His work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, The Walrus, The Globe and Mail, Best Canadian Essays, and elsewhere. He lives in Hamilton with his family. And speaking of family, this episode is kind of a love letter to his wife, who is, in her own right, a strong, talented writer. But we also discuss many of the other female writers who really inspired Nathan's voice when it comes to writing in a place that's not really his personal experience necessarily, not entirely. And along with that, we talked about writing amid grief, intense grief on Nathan's part, and how community and perseverance and strength and ultimately love for what we do can help get you back to a place where you can create again and you can create authentically. This was a really fun conversation. Nathan likes to talk. It's a little longer than our normal, but what he has to say, it's powerful. And Lonely Writer, I hope that you take away from this conversation what I did. Inspiration to power through the really hard, dark times and hold on to our storytelling. You know, let it be a life raft. This is a good one. Enjoy the show. Thank you for joining me today, Nathan. I'm so excited to get to chat with you on the show. We've chatted lots in person, which mm-hmm. is odd because normally I never meet people in person anymore. But I'm excited to get the chance to chat with you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me. I know intimately the stress and pain and tears involved in trying to get people on your podcast. Not just your podcast, any podcast.
Yeah,
there's no worse message to send than, will you please be on my podcast?
It is. It's a bit like, asking all of your friends to help you move. Like, I'll give you a case of beer, please. Like,
yeah.
No, I'm really excited. And the first thing I like to jump in with is your author origin story. So you've got quite the back story for yourself, but I would love to know kind of more what was, were you that like angsty teen who was like pouring all his thoughts into like his journals or his scribblers, or like what really like pointed you in the direction of becoming an author?
I think it was, I've talked about this before, but honestly, up until about grade 11-ish, I thought I was going to be a musician. I thought I was going to be like in a band. I mean, I was in a band. I thought I was going to be touring and playing shows, and that was my life. I would even like spend a lot of time, doing the thing in the binder where you're designing logos and designing my drum kit. And, it was honestly my belief that I would be living as a touring musician. And it wasn't the usual kind of, I'll be an astronaut or I will be, a billionaire. I mean, I was good friends and the guy I was playing with did become a touring musician and moved to LA and got a record deal and did it and still is doing it and has like worked with a lot of like big people. So I could have slotted myself into that life. But at some point, I just realized I don't like the lifestyle of I for some reason I just started I think it was the only way I can think of it, the only clue I got was I remember I was really into the Beatles. I was a huge Beatles fan, like obsessive to the point of like, I know who plays tambourine on the third track of that album, you know, and did you know that it was actually Paul McCartney at drums on that song? That nerdy level. And this is like the mid to late 80s. So this is not, you know, not the usual way you're supposed to behave. But I remember reading a story about the Beatles touring. I think it was in Japan. And the organizers of the tour were very strict about times and schedules. And it was like they were getting these schedules that would say, we will be knocking at your hotel door at 4:35. By 4:37, we will be at the elevators. At 4:40, we will be leaving, exiting the lobby of the building and entering the van or limo or whatever. At 4:51, we will enter the venue. And they would look at these and they would laugh, but they would also feel like, well, we're of course going to screw with this. And they would like lock the doors and they wouldn't answer and they would intentionally mess up the schedule. And it was all the whole point of the story being like, ah, the charming Beatles, they just cause anarchy wherever they go. And I read that. I'm like, I don't want to live a life where like I'm getting schedules that I'm going to have to go to this thing and go to this thing and go to this thing and go to this thing. And I also don't want to live a life where I want to be in like close proximity with three other guys or four other guys for like weeks on end or even days on end where you're just like, you're just doing this thing. I also realized like, I don't know that I really want to play music that much. Like I still play music a lot, but I don't know if I like it that much. It's not that deep in my soul, I guess. And so I found that I was more attracted to this thing that I was doing anyway, since I was a little kid, which was just reading. And I found like, that's kind of the world. I had no idea what the literary world was, but I felt like that's more what I want to do, where you're kind of on your own for as much as you want to be. And then you can kind of join groups of people, but then you can recede and join and recede and join and receive. You don't have to be present, you know, all the time. And so that's kind of where my head just drifted. And it's kind of been the same thing ever since. I keep one or two toes in music because I do enjoy it, but I enjoy it on such a hobby level, whereas writing is it's a need. It's an absolute need. And it became a need at some point. And I couldn't even explain exactly why, except it was kind of all the negatives of being a musician hit me and realized like, it doesn't suit my personality. And I know that my heart and brain and is mostly somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you get to go back to writing books, which is, you know, your love. And like you said, it's your need. And your latest book is a really beautiful example of how you are meant to be doing this. It's been almost 7 years since your last book. Mm-hmm. And you know,
thank you for reminding me. Yes. Yeah. I need to keep that drill. Well, anytime I feel good about,
I swear, anytime I
get a little
this
bit of ego, I have to get that
because
back. Yeah,
I say this because it's impressive for me because you kept busy. Like one of the things I often see when we have this big span of time in between authors publishing books is that if, they're always talking about how it was such a grind to get the next book out, and they kind of receded into their fortress of solitude and wept over the pages they couldn't, write, and then eventually got this book out. Whereas, like, you kept busy, like, you have a family, and you head up Humber's creative book publishing program, you've got your own podcast, What Happened Next, and like, so if anything, it's actually interesting to me. What I'd love to find out before we get too much into what, your book Lump is about, is because something I talk about a lot on the show is our big why of writing. Like, why do we want to be published? There is no wrong why, but what is it? So 7 years goes by, you're keeping yourself busy. Why did you come back to novel writing? And why in particular this story? Was this the story that brought you back to it? Or you just had, again, that kind of need was revived to write, and the story came from somewhere else?
It wasn't so much that I came back. It's that I was able to get back. I was sort of forcibly ejected in 2016 from novel writing because that was when that my last book, Congratulations on Everything. I've been told you just keep saying the titles of books when you're being interviewed so that it drills it into people's ears and minds. When that book came out, it was May 2016, and that was the it literally launched during the same week as I was completing my 7th week of chemo and radiation
Oh, wow.
because I had throat cancer that was discovered like at the beginning of that year, something like mid-January or something. It was found, and I was sent up to Sunnybrook, and I would do these daily radiation treatments where they like blasted my neck, and then I would do weekly chemo. So literally the week that book launched, I was finishing my final rounds of chemo. So the final round of chemo was the day after my book launch, at which I played the drums because that's what I do like that's my defense mechanism is I like there's got to be drums involved that I've got to like put that between me and the can't do a reading. I've got to like put a band together and I did it again this year. I did it again at my Hamilton launch. So it was, I got it out, and even at the launch, it was like I had what I've seen described as like performer's energy or performer's adrenaline. I was like fine. And then at like 9 p.m., I just went, my energy crashed.
Right.
I had to be sort of driven home by my mother-in-law. And that kind of was it. Like 3 days later, I had a pulmonary embolism. I had like a blood clot in my
Oh,
lung. I
wow.
was in the hospital. I was doing blood thinners for the next 6 months. I was like shooting myself, injecting myself with blood thinners. I had a feeding tube in my chest. Like I couldn't eat or drink. I was like squirting this gross, like protein drink into this thing, and I would just feel it fill up my belly. It's great. And so all through that period, I was basically living on a couch
Wow.
and not really existing fully in the world. It was, I mean, I've written a little bit about it. My wife, Megan Strymas, has written a little bit about it because she wrote an essay in this book that came out last year called Good Mom on Paper, all about like motherhood and creativity. And she wrote about that period just because she was writing a book. She was writing her last collection of poetry during that period as a way of like getting through, and she describes basically I was not really existing. I was just living on the couch and kind of I don't know, I think I weighed about 110 pounds or something like that. Like I was a skeleton. And so writing, just as much as it was always something I wanted to do, and it killed me that I couldn't get back to it, but I just couldn't. It took me so long to get back to it. And I also knew that I wanted to teach. That had already been my goal, is to get more into teaching. So I always wanted to get back to writing. But I was offered another teaching job. I was teaching already, but I was offered another teaching job in September. The treatment had ended in May. It was way too early for me to go back and do that, but I did it anyway. And I just basically was exhausted for about a year and a half and could not find the mental space. I probably tried writing a little bit during that time. And as you probably know, if you've not done it for a long time, it's like with anything else, it takes a while to warm your writing brains and muscles up to where you feel comfortable. But in a state where I was already physically uncomfortable and already mentally uncomfortable, more than I realized at the time, looking back, I was out of my mind. You know, basically traumatized. I was had like a mild kind of PTSD that I was working through. And we had some friends, Priscilla Uppel and Tava Harrison, who were literally dying around us from cancer. So it was kind of hard to go like, I beat it, I'm out, and the world is great. My wife
almost
Megan,
like survivor's guilt.
There was a lot of survivor's guilt. My wife was actually working with Priscilla and then worked with Tava, like on editing their final books, like in the hospital with them, like as they're like lying. It was a horrible, horrible time. I don't know how she made it through, honestly. Like she's the strongest person I've ever met in my life to do that. Right. I would have crumbled. So there was never a moment where I could say I'm in the clear, the sun is out. It was just constant guilt and exhaustion. And then I was teaching new classes and I was really eager to get teaching. I started taking an online MFA with UBC with the idea that I need an MFA to get full-time teaching. The college went on strike. All of the colleges in Ontario went on strike. So I was now walking a picket line and doing an MFA, trying to write a book, trying to get over cancer. It was ridiculous. It was all of this was kind of making it impossible to get any kind of clarity.
Right. It's one of the most extreme examples, but it really is so, you know, it's such a good example of when, you know, we have kind of the non-creative people in our life, the logical people who say, well, just sit down at your computer at 9 a.m. and just write. And it's like, it really like your creative muscles and what we pull stories from, even if it's fiction or what have you, it is all tied to your soul. And if your soul is absolutely exhausted and done and empty and the tank is empty, you can't, no matter how much willpower you have, no matter how many ideas you have, you just cannot create. And that must have been, you know, simultaneously heartbreaking as well to not be able to get back to that.
It was. I mean, I have a particular genius for compartmentalization. I can like take all that and go boop boop and then be like, that's the bad stuff. I will look at that later. I have to focus on this.
Right.
I can do that very well, but I can only do it for a certain amount of time before those boxes start to like smell and things start to seep out of them.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh no, I got to deal with this a little bit. The other thing that was happening is we had been living in a rented house in Toronto for a stupidly low rent, and we got rent evicted. And we had to move in with my sister-in-law for most of a year. Then we were very, very lucky to have found a place in Hamilton, which we bought for much cheaper than it would be for right now. And we did a big move and we changed cities and we changed, and then the pandemic hit as soon as we moved. So that was just seemed like thing after thing, you know, was pushing away the ability to really write.
Right.
And I was writing, the thing I was writing all the time, I was writing.
Yeah.
And I was working on this novel. I had actually started writing it before I even got diagnosed with cancer. It was something
really?
I'd already begun. Yeah. And I had imagined kind of whipping it together in a year or something. It seemed like I understood the whole story. I knew what I was writing about. But all of these things kept, you know, making it harder.
Yeah.
And I think part of the problem was that compartmentalization, where I was in the moment, I was thinking like, no, I can do it. I'm working every day. I'm hitting my word count, and I'm not noticing that like the book is at, you know, 200,000 words, and I've barely like started the plot, which is something I do a lot. I've just gone off on all of these digressions, and I'm basically like self-workshopping everything into the ground. So if I had had the clarity to say like, wait a minute, you are like fucked in the head right now. You need to relax and take a break and go sit in a chair and read. I also just couldn't do it because I had a little kid in the house. So I have two other kids who were in high school at the time. Like there was a lot going on.
Right.
That I probably wasn't recognizing was what was keeping me from finishing it. I'm also just, despite the fact that I try to write every day and I try to hit a word count and I try to be productive, I'm a slow writer. I write a
Same.
lot, but it feels like I'm pouring sand onto like a sieve, and I'm pouring and I'm pouring.
Right.
And then I look again and it's just like a few little pebbles have been kept, and I'm like, oh crap, and I'm like, more sand.
Yeah.
And eventually the pebbles are, there's enough pebbles, and I've got a book, but it takes a long time to get there. I'm not a first draft genius, I'll tell you that.
No, I'm not either. I'm incredibly slow writer, and I'm also like, I like to consider myself like I'm like an archaeologist of my stories. Like so much of my writing is figuring it out, is, and not just like, oh, I'll sit there and brainstorm. Like I'll write whole chapters of backstory that will never see the light of day, but for me now in my brain, I get it, I get where this goes, I get where this, but I can imagine, so you're already doing that, but you're also kind of probably almost journaling a little bit. A lot of your writing was probably a lot of like self-reflection into your characters that you couldn't, you know, verbalize or that kind of thing. And I can imagine that really felt like chasing your tail.
Again, because I'm a white male of a certain age, I'm just mostly disassociated from my own my own problems.
Oh, are we going to talk about toxic masculinity?
Yeah, yeah.
Inability to access emotions. And
there's some truth to that, you know.
Yeah.
There's some reason why people talk about that. I was probably doing that, but without any awareness of doing that.
Right.
The only moment I became aware that I was consciously processing some of the things that I went through was the chapter in Lump, in which the main character or one of the main characters, kind of central character, Kat, goes to the doctor and is told she has cancer. That was the only chapter that was remotely autobiographical, because that was somewhat how I experienced it, in the sense of showing up at the doctor, having done some tests, waiting to be told there's nothing there, don't worry about it, go home. And the doctor acting as if I had already been told, and kind of skipping the telling me part and getting into the like, okay, so we're going to go to be going to Sunnybrook or Princess Margaret. We'll figure out when you talk to your oncologist, we'll see if how much radiation. I'm like, whoa, 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 you're burying the lead.
Yeah.
Let's go back a few steps. Can we, you know, you're planning the wedding and you haven't
yet
like,
the blow?
Proposed to me yet. Like
yeah.
you haven't shown me the ring yet. It was that was the sort of that was the moment I realized, like, oh, this is something I wanted to get out, because that was a horrible, horrible moment of realization, like, oh, they're not going to tell me it's okay. They're not planning to tell me, like, get out of here. It's fine.
I wasn't over exaggerating. You
know? Yeah. It's just a bee sting, you goofball. don't eat so many eggs. Maybe like I wanted to hear there was some weird thing that I was doing. So I probably was doing that and not realizing it. Although I always feel like my process for all three of my books is that they are 100% autobiographical. I've just gone in and like photoshopped myself out of the story. It's like it's the story going on around me and I'm just not in it, you know? But all of that stuff is stuff that I know.
Yeah, that actually brings me to one of the questions I had. And so first, we're going to just take it back a little bit and we're going to tell the listeners a little bit more about Lump. So I'm going to grab my copy here.
A, it's brilliant. B, you have to buy it. C, it's very affordable.
It has a duck on it. So
it has
that sold me right there.
Yes.
But I'm going to grab my jacket copy and I'm going to give a little read here so that the listeners know a bit more about Lump. Kat's career has stalled. Her marriage has gone flat, and being a stay-at-home mom for two young kids has become a grind. When she finds out, all within a few days, that she is pregnant, that a lump in her breast is the worst thing it could be, and that her husband has done something unforgivable, she responds by running away from her marriage and her life. A life that, on the outside, looks like middle-class success. Her actions send waves of chaos through the lives of multiple characters, including a struggling house cleaner, a rich and charismatic yoga guru, and even an ailing dog. What follows is a dark comedy about marriage, motherhood, privilege, and power. So what actually my question, and I'm really glad we kind of circled around to this, because one of my questions was, I'm going to be real honest, and this is probably going to get me some hate, I really struggle reading male authors writing female characters.
Sure.
And it's not that it can't be done. I've read some fantastic characters created by male authors, but so often it really falls into that male gaze, you know, area where like it really feels like they've sat at a coffee shop and watched a couple ladies at brunch and they think that's how women feel and act. And it's very, it's very uncomfortable a lot of the time to read it. But Lump, I was actually very pleasantly surprised because Kat, even from the very first page, Kat was so relatable and authentic. And it really was very impressive to see how well you wrote her in a way that made you didn't feel like a male author was writing a female character. It just felt like a female character. So my question is, you know, you talk about, you know, you Photoshop yourself out of it. The experiences are all there. What for you, you know, Lump is from different POVs, but Kat in particular, what was your process for writing in her voice and finding that, you know, I mean, essentially writing a female character is out of your kind of personal experience wheelhouse, but you did it in such a way that it didn't feel that way. So what was kind of the process of finding her voice and doing so authentically?
Well, first of all, high five, bro, that you enjoyed the book. just dispelling all the like good feelings.
Yes.
It's because I'm going to start this on a really meta level, but it's actually relates to, this is going to sound so stupid, but I'm a huge fan of, one of the authors I'm a huge fan of is Rachel Cusk. Mm-hmm. I became, when her, you know, Outline trilogy came out, I was resistant to it from the way I read about it. It was nominated for the Giller, and I was reading things about it. It was this cold, like weird arch, slightly avant-garde thing that didn't have any kind of emotional connection. And I was like, I tried it and I was like, oh my God, I love this. It's funny. Mm-hmm. Of course it's like odd and slightly left field, but it's really, when you get the rhythm of it, you realize how funny and actually warm it is. And I went and I read everything she's ever written, and I continue to, and I've written essays about her and I review her stuff. Although I've said in reviews that, like, I never want to meet her because I feel like A, she's probably like would intimidate the hell out of me and would like squash me like a bug. B, some of the things I've read, you know, probably not the greatest person in the world, but that's neither here nor there. But I read an interview. I was writing this essay about her like body of work. I wrote it for Canadian Notes and Queries. I wrote this thing about her entire career. And I read an interview where someone was talking to her about the fact that she was born in Saskatchewan. She's technically a Canadian citizen. Although she moved away and when she was two and didn't come back to Canada till she was nominated for the Giller. And they said, oh, well, you are a Canadian. You're a Canadian writer. And she said, well, that's just a weird quirk of birth. And she, before she kind of came back for the Giller, she, and I am getting back to your point. I will answer your question. Before she came back,
it's all good.
Before she came back, her conception of Canadian writers and specifically female Canadian writers were Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro, maybe Margaret Lawrence, maybe who am I forgetting? Mavis Gallant, like the big kind of pre-1980s, like, and so her voices, conception of female Canadian writers were like, they are these like tough, badass, killer writers who you don't go up against. There is no, you don't compete with, you don't put them yourself in the category. So she was like, I could never be, she actually says, like, I could never be in that category. And then she said the line that I've been going around the field to get to, where she says, like, I would have loved to have been considered a female Canadian writer, because in her conception, that meant you were like an Atwood or a Munro or a Gallant. You were like these tough, no nonsense, unsentimental, like just, you know, powerful writers. And then she goes on to say, like, she came here for the Giller and was shocked that everyone was so anxious and had no confidence. And everyone's like, do you like us? Does anybody read Canadians over in the Brits? And you're like,
yeah.
She's like, what? Wait, I thought you were all like tough and badass. So really, it's part of it is just literally wanting to be a tough Canadian, female Canadian writer. That's my model. My model isn't like my period of idolizing like the Beats and Kerouac and Bukowski and all that, like that lasted a very short time. And I was, once I was out of my teens, that went away.
Talk about not good people.
Yeah. Or even just idolizing the ethos of like dudes who like can do whatever they want. And I found I started to, you know, it was probably reading Alice Munro that did it, that I started to realize like, oh, this is the shit. I actually, there was a period a few years ago where I wanted to write an essay that basically argued that it's the male writers who are sentimental, that they are the ones that are schlocky and corny. And if you read like Richard Ford, and I had a whole, you know, this was years ago,
but
I had this whole list of like the guy writers. And I was like, no, they're the schlocky sentimental ones, because the thing about middle-aged straight white guys is they are schlocky and corny, because they're like, oh, I could have been a hockey player, but my knee went out. Or I hung out with all my, they all peaked in high school and my dudes.
A lot of
my,
wallowing in the past.
Yes.
And, yeah. But
for a lot of women, and not all women, but for a lot of women, it's like, no, I had to get, I became aware of the reality of the world at like 11, you know, when my uncle noticed my breasts, or some guy tried to impregnate me, or I'm literally mansplaining to you.
But you know what? It's important. I enjoy hearing you, and I'll let you finish here, but I enjoy hearing this because essentially what you're saying is, male authors need to be reading female authors.
They
need to be listening to the women in their lives, they need to be surrounded. And it's, of course, we don't want to say even binaries, right? Well, we don't want to say only males, only females. Like, it's more a case of we need to be admiring and we need to be ingesting so many different kinds of writers with different perspectives. Because if we're, like you said, if we're just reading Kerouac knockoff, it's, you're not going to get that like wide breadth of like experience and voice, and that's what it really sounds like you're saying.
But it's also it is, but it's also like it's not as if I'm saying it as a kind of you need these nutrients. You need to, it's fine if you want a burger, but you got to eat some salad with your burger. Eat some carrot sticks because you don't want to get scurvy. You got to eat some fruit. It's not a good for you thing at all. I'm not making a good for you argument. I'm literally saying like I don't get a lot of pleasure out of reading like dude writers. Like I find it really, I read someone like, or I try to read someone like Jonathan Franzen or even like the big dudes like Cormac McCarthy or someone like, and it feels alien to me at this point. That feels really corny and sentimental because I'm like, buddy, you're not thinking this way. This is not how the world is. This is not how life is lived. You're thinking that way because the fundamental reality is you can walk out of the house at any time and you've got your freedom. Like you can walk down any street at any time, day, night, and you're not going to get jumped. Maybe you get jumped for your wallet, but you'll make it out of there with a couple of bruises. You've not had to think about like these things.
The stakes aren't as high
And you
just
could
for
literally
existing.
like you could rename this episode Nathan like Virtue Signals for an hour because that's exactly I know. Also, the reality is like the person I spend my most of my waking hours with is my wife, and she is herself an incredibly smart, powerful, strong woman, and it's an outlook that I really subscribe to, and I can't shake it. Like most of the writers I read for the past more than the past decade, they've all been women. Like I find it odd when I'm writing a male writer. There's a few that I will come back to, and they're like, they're not the most noble, virtuous guys in the world, but I get impatient with male writers. I get impatient. I feel like there's something missing. Like there's literally like there's a perspective I'm missing out on of like it feels like the stakes are different in those stories. The stakes are if this happens, I might feel bad or I might be a little depressed or things didn't really work out as well as they could have. Where I'm like, those aren't stakes. Those aren't narrative stakes. Stakes are like, things fall apart and your body falls apart. And so that's kind of where I live imaginatively. And I'm fully aware that I'm like doing that with again with a big t-shirt saying, "Hi, I'm a feminist, ladies. Don't worry about me. I'm unproblematic." But I can't write any other way now. I'm working on a new novel, and it's also the main character is a woman, and the other main character is a woman, and it's again family dynamics, and it's I
Well,
don't my
actually,
imagination can't go anywhere else.
that actually brings me to one of my final questions.
Are we
What
at
are
the
you
final
working on
question?
next?
Final question already? Wow. I have
I know.
blathered.
If no, it's trust me. Normally you have to pull teeth to get people to chat. And so I'm happy to not be the one filling the silence. So, but can you tell us about what is, coming next and what you're working on?
I can tell you that it's another it's going to be very tonally similar to Lump in the sense that it's funny, dark. It's about people who do, casually terrible things. It won't be an eco thriller. It won't be sci-fi. It won't be speculative fiction. It won't be a thriller. It's going to be about like shitty people within a family, an extended family doing pretty shitty things, making terrible decisions. That's
my
but
favorite kind of story.
that's what it's going to be. It's going to wallow. I will say that I'm trying not to do the multiple perspective thing this time. It's going to
Okay.
be one character's perspective so far. And that I am finally, it's now half set half in Toronto and half in Hamilton. So I'm finally like moving into my actual town. And instead of cancer, the underlying threat or the underlying theme is the housing market and I guess aging parents. That's the other, those are the
Okay.
two threads, aging parents and the ridiculous price of houses. So
Very,
that's
very
all I can really say
relevant
about it at this point.
themes right now. That's you're gonna have a lot of angry renters picking
Yes.
that
Yeah. If you've ever had trouble with being, you know, with renting or buying or anything, this will be the book for you.
That's like 98% of
Right.
us.
Exactly. Exactly. And the other 2%, I don't want to know from you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, they'll be in the Goodreads comments, so. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Nathan. Can you let our listeners know where they can find you online to stay up to date on everything, bookish?
Everything me. I have a website, nathanwhitlock.ca. I used to have one, nathanwhitlock.com, but my brother who was helping me with it let the license lapse, and now I think it's
Oh,
just
no.
like garbage on there if it doesn't if there's anything on there, which is a fake plot point in my last book. And I'm on Instagram. I think it's like Nathan underscore underscore Whitlock because that's the only one I could get. And I'm still on Twitter or, you know, X. I'm still hanging out there, although it feels like I'm in an empty
One of the
hall.
last.
Yeah. And there's like Nazi parades going on outside. And I'm just going, does anybody want to hear something mildly amusing? You know, it's, I'm one of the last.
That's perfect description of Twitter slash X, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Well, if you have not picked up a copy of Lump, I want to make sure, listeners, that you head out to your local independent bookseller, grab yourself a copy. If they don't have a copy on the shelves, you want to email them, tweet them, call them, whatever you want to do, because those booksellers definitely want to put the books in our hands and we want to always remember to support them. Thank you so much again, Nathan.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite show. Thank you again, and until next time, Lonely Writers, be well.